watches the watchman who guards the gatekeepers? Today we're talking to Lauren Ashburn, a former television journalist and managing editor at USA Today Live. She is founder and editor-in-chief of The Daily Download, a website that focuses not only on the news, but the way the news industry covers the news. My name is Michael O'Connell. I'm here with producer Megan Clougherty and our guest, Julie O'Donohue from Northwestern. And today we're talking to Lauren Ashburn. Hi, Lauren.
Hello, everybody.
So how did you launch Daily Download?
Well, I used to be an executive at USA Today in Gannett, running the television division there, and for USA Today. And I felt like there was a void in the marketplace when it came to media and media coverage and media criticism. Plus, there is just this wealth of information out there that isn't curated, and there's so many cool tools and so many cool new social media sites and apps and so many things that nonprofits are doing that I found it was hard to know what was good, what was bad, what was even out there. Mm-hmm. So that's when we went to the Knight Foundation and said, hey, how about giving us some cash? And we will put together some videos for you that will air on public television stations across the country, and we'll put a website with it.
So would you describe these videos as more like news industry focused or sort of news commentary?
Well, we have two types of videos on dailydownload.com. We have 1 minute interstitials, which appear on PBS stations across the country. They are basically an analysis or a summary of websites or apps or different products. So we have done things, you know, from as basic as Pinterest, when Pinterest popped up and that became much more of a mainstream product, to something on the super PACs, where during the election you could find out where all the money was coming from and where all of it was going.
Now, tell me about the Knight Foundation grant. That's a two-year grant?
It's a two-year grant, yeah. Eric Newton is a prince and a fabulous person, and I will always be indebted to him. We went to him. He was at the time running the division that handed out the grants, and now he's moved on to the executive C-suite level. But Eric really saw that there was a need. You know, the Knight Foundation funds tons and tons of these interesting and cool projects, and so he thought, well, you know, they don't always get a lot of play, and wouldn't it be great to have a website and a clearinghouse that would not only address the Knight-funded projects, I mean, it wasn't a vanity project for him, but would talk about the role of social media and give people the opportunity to sample these products and to learn about them, whether or not they're, you know, 70 or 25.
Now, what insights have you gotten so far about, you know, what's going on now in the news industry with social media, with what's going on with the shift to digital?
Well, what we found with Daily Download is that there's never a problem writing about new things. I mean, there's always a new site. There's always something that mainstream media is trying to do to catch up to Silicon Valley. And so there's just a lot of information out there. So we're never at a loss for something to cover or something to talk about in those videos. But what we found is that there's also not a lot of media criticism, and we have been able to carve out a niche there. We have about 700,000 uniques, and we started 6 months ago.
Wow.
And so there's really a niche there for people in the industry, but people who also follow media. I mean, people love to hate journalists and media, and so anytime there's any criticism of it, you know, it really strikes a nerve. Anyway, so we have found, though, that, well, what I have found personally is while I had this mission, I didn't realize that it would be so much more negative than just writing a story, talking about it, and going on TV as I do to, you know, to talk about the things I write about or do. There is this tenor on social media that can be really nasty.
It's sort of snarkiness.
It's not even snarky. I mean, I've had death threats. Oh, sure. I've had people say, you know, I did a media commentary on the New York Post when it ran the front page cover of the man who
was hit by the train
and the freelance photographer who took the picture just as he was about to be hit. And people said, why don't you jump in front of the train? And this is all on Twitter. You know, you, you go to your at mention and you say, whoa, okay, little anger issues there, folks. You know, and so I have found that it's not just me. I mean, when George H.W. was in the ICU recently for battling, I guess he had bronchitis or some sort of illness, coughing and fever and all of that, people were saying on Twitter, I hope he dies a painful death. You know, and you're watching that. And then most recently on Fox News, everybody was, a lot of the commenters, a lot of the analysts were saying that they didn't believe that Hillary Clinton had fallen and had a concussion and that she actually
this is all
was faking it. And it was Benghazi flu because she didn't want to testify.
Right. It was all obfuscating that story that that somehow she was hiding.
That was all over Twitter, too. Not just,
No, it was. And people were really mean about it. And this sort of translated to the air, where people were mean on the air. So, you know, what I'm finding through creating this website and doing these nationally broadcasted videos is that there's an underbelly to this whole wonderful invention called social media. I mean, I love Facebook. I love Twitter. I love discovering things like Pinterest and learning about Discus and learning about all of the different creative tools that mainstream media have to put together in order to stay relevant, in order to reach these audiences that really are getting their news from places like Twitter. I mean, Twitter's really become the new AP. You know, I would wake up in the morning and
check that first,
right to my Twitter feed because I follow cool people who are interested in what I'm interested in, and bam, I know the hot stories of the day already. What really throws you, though, is when, like, political reporters start commenting on Kim Kardashian and the fact that she's pregnant. I'm like, wait.
Well, it's like, where does that wall, as for a journalist then, you know, what is it, you know, on the one hand, they encourage people to, put your personality in it, because people, that's one of the things about social media is that people react to that, that, you know, they like getting the information, but they also like to have, you know, have that insight into the person's attitude, that they're thinking and what interests them. And so then that's all fun and good until somebody says the wrong thing.
Loses an eye.
Yeah, and then suddenly 10,000 people are blasting them on Twitter because, you know, oh, you dared to say this.
A lot of people have been fired over things that they have said on Twitter. And a lot of people have said some really dumb things that should have made them be fired. I mean, the older, really powerful men who have no PR filter, like Jack Welch, who can say that the unemployment numbers were cooked up when they did well right before the election.
And then it's like, well, what does that mean? You know, you challenge them, you know.
Right. And you just wonder how they were able to do that. I mean, he's not running a company now, but Rupert Murdoch said some very nasty things about Jewish-owned press and was really taken to task for it. And I'm sure it's something they're firing off at, you know, right in there while they're in their bedroom and they're just going, oh, I think this is terrible. And there's no sort of filter for it. And that's part of the problem with social media. I mean, not when it comes to journalists. Journalists can make mistakes. They can say things that maybe have gone a little bit too far. They can say things that maybe
are too opinionated.
Too opinionated, exactly. But what I find from just general folks is that the more anonymous you can be, you know, you don't have to put your name out there. You can be, you know, Joe Blow. You can be, you know, I hate people at I hate people. And you, nobody has to know who you are. So you can really be as vicious as you want to be.
There's no
with
accountability.
No no consequences.
And, that's empowering for some people who feel they have no voice. That, you know, they create a separate account or even their own account. You know, I'm, you know, John Smith, and I think that you're an idiot. I think that you can't do this. And, you know, that's
like a sounding board.
Sadly, human nature.
Well, and that's what I love about social media is that everybody can weigh in, right? It's not the, you know, editors to the public. You know, it's everybody has a voice. And I love that as a believer in the First Amendment, as a journalist, who I've been a journalist my whole life. I mean, I'm all about that. But it's, as I said, as we got into it at Daily Download, you find that I'm constantly saying this. Well, you know, Twitter is more snarky, and you can have David Axelrod saying things that he wouldn't normally say on Twitter. You know, he wouldn't say that, make fun of Mitt Romney putting Seamus the dog on the roof of his car and, you know, take a picture with Bo sitting in the presidential limo and tweet that out, you know, saying, oh, well, this is how you take care of a dog. You know, I mean, you just don't see that.
As far as your users, is it mostly journalists who are interested in where the industry is going and what tools are at their disposal? Or is it more people who want to be critical of journalists? Or what are you finding as far as feedback goes?
So our audience really has turned out to be the influentials, we like to call them, the people who in Washington and
the
New
elites?
York. And, no, not the elites. They don't have money. They have power.
Social power.
Yeah, right.
Right.
Right. And so we find that a lot of people in the industry who are at big jobs and, you know, they want to make sure they know what's being said and who's being criticized. And so that's where a lot of our audience comes from. It comes from New York, Washington, and L.A. But there is a significant part of the middle of the country and regular folks who really hate media and want to weigh in on their mistakes. And that is what has been surprising to me.
Well, my own experience as a journalist, because sometimes you get really full of yourself. You feel like, oh, I've written this great story. I've done this great series. I've done something really, you know, important and helpful to the community and everything. But then sooner or later, you run into somebody who reminds you that journalists, you know, on the scale of things are maybe just this much more less despised than politicians.
Right, that's right.
We can look down our nose at politicians and lawyers, maybe.
We're scum of the earth to a lot of people, and so you know those are the people who like to read this. But I also find that people. Well, one of the stories that did really well for us was by one of our columnists, contributors, David Zurawick, who's the Baltimore Sun critic, TV critic, and he did a piece for us talking about why Chelsea Clinton was a terrible journalist and why she was a pretend journalist. And Drudge picked it up. Matt Drudge's site picked it up, and it just went on fire because, you know, obviously Drudge picked it up because he has the right bent, right wing bent.
Really?
And so, yeah, right, really? Huh? And it stayed up for the whole weekend, and people were just loving that somebody was bashing a Clinton. Right. And then another piece that did really well for us was the piece that I wrote about how Hillary Clinton was being bashed for, you know, as we talked about earlier, for the Benghazi flu. And so it's and all the left wing sites picked that up,
right?
You know, as to say, oh, look at these Fox News people.
Sure.
And then, you know, the right ones pick up, oh, look at Chelsea Clinton. You know, she's the daughter of, who does she think she is? And so that's good for our traffic, actually, because we get it. We get it from both sides. But, you know, I get called a Republican shill, and then I get called an elitist Democrat, you know. And so, but I feel like that's when we know that we're doing our job and we're holding the media accountable.
I was going to say that's a good
when
thing if it's coming from
everybody hates
sides.
Us, right?
When we are hated the most, we are doing our best.
That's right. That's
Tell
right.
us a little bit about your contributors, because you mentioned
sure.
Baltimore Sun
David
and Howard
Zurich,
as well.
Howie Kurtz, sure. Howard Kurtz, longtime Washington Post media critic, started out as a media reporter. He writes for us and does a bang up job. He always has great insights, and we're really lucky to have him. He has, you know, his experience, and he's always the thing I like the most about his writing is that he's fair, and we try to be fair. You know, we've got, as I said, we do pieces that are on both sides. We're equal opportunity critics, and his pieces are. Really bring a depth and a context that nobody else could bring.
Do you guys have, I mean, as far as deadlines go, do you guys have new content every day? Or for editorial decision making, do you just go with the news cycle? Or?
No, we have a managing editor named Ben Jacobs, who used to write for the Daily Beast. And he outlines our editorial coverage. And yes, sometimes we do it off of the news. I mean, you know, we Howie and I do these videos every day that are analyzing what is happening in the news. So today we'll do one on the fact that Lance Armstrong is leaking to the New York Times that he may be ready to admit to doping. And what does that mean? You know, the media has been following this story for you know, years, since the 90s. And were we hoodwinked? And how did we let it get so far that we were... The story was always Lance is great. I mean, you know, and so what does that look like? You know, who was criticizing him?
So is this sort of a mea culpa of the news industry that this is why weren't we more diligent? Why weren't we the people who exposed us 10 years ago instead of doing it now.
There is that. So the other contributors we have, we really try to do a good job of including students. We have a team of student writers who sometimes get on, sometimes don't, but are always helpful in, you know, they do submit some really good posts, and then other times they fill out the blanks, fill in the blanks behind the videos that we do for the PBS stations. So they will call up the companies and get the quotes and sort of do the research. If we're going to do something on Spotify, they'll call Spotify, they'll do actual interviews, and we'll feed that into the story that is written around the video that we have done. So we feel it's really important. I always feel that it's really important to give back. I know that my greatest experiences and what brought me to this profession were my internships.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's good to have that perspective, too, from a younger perspective on the news, which obviously... coming from different
spots. I don't have.
Well, no, I mean, but I think...
What are you saying? I'm old?
Well, I mean, it's interesting, though, that they might not think about the 90s baseball thing. I mean, you know, they were all younger, whereas as Lance Armstrong was this, you know, iconic figure who has fallen from grace.
Everybody's wearing a bracelet.
Yeah, they might have a different perspective on what that means.
They bring a lot to the table about video games.
Well, there you go.
These kids today.
I have a question. Do you, in terms of like seasoned, I'll call them seasoned journalists, who do you think is doing a good job adjusting to social media? Mm-hmm. Like the person that I think of who does a good job, I'm in Chicago right now, is Roger Ebert has done a pretty good job. Obviously, he's got other challenges, mm-hmm. so maybe this is a good outlet for him.
Right. Well, not to toot our own horn, but Howard Kurtz was one of the first people who had a blog before anybody knew what a blog was. He has 150,000 Twitter followers. He updates his Twitter. He blogs. He writes long-form stories. He does TV. He has his own TV show. I mean, that's as multimedia as you get. Susan Page at USA Today is just like that.
Yeah, she does a good
job. Susan Page, she hosts the Diane Rehm Show occasionally. She writes. She's the Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today. She tweets. She Facebooks. She is involved in a lot of panel discussions, and she's on TV all the time talking about her point of view. And that's really what it takes right now to be a journalist. And if you're in TV, you have to, or radio, you have to know how to edit. You know, you have to know how to shoot now. If you're coming up, thank God I'm not coming up in right now. So, if I had to shoot, it would be really bad.
It's sort of a one-man band anymore.
Although, actually, I'm shooting with an iPhone. Sometimes we do our videos with just an iPhone, a tripod, and a mic that plugs in. Now they have this boom mic that you can actually plug into iPhones, and it's just a snap.
Yeah, we did a interview with Neil Augenstein from TOP, and he does all of his reports from an iPhone
in his car.
Right. So it's like, you know, it's the mobility aspect of it, that, you know, the is incredible, and how it sort of streamlined the way people do things. I want to go back something you were talking about with social media, because I know there was a lot of talk before the election about how much social media was going to play into it. How much do you think social media played into it?
Well, Howie and I do a segment on PBS NewsHour, and we do that every other week, and it talks about social media and the presidential election, and now it's we've been renewed for the next year, and we'll be talking about social media and politics. So I have a great depth of knowledge about how it played in. What we found is that in 2008, obviously, Barack Obama made presidential elections about social media and reaching his younger base through all of the different outlets, through Facebook and Twitter. Well, this year, they took their operation and just quadrupled it. And with all of the information that they learned from 2008, they put into 2012. And their team was all over social media, including the fact that they would advertise on Xbox. So if you're on an Xbox video game, an ad would pop up that would say, you know, vote, go out, get out the vote. It was a get out the vote campaign. And always 10-1. It was a 10-1 ratio of the number of followers that Barack Obama had to Mitt Romney, that, you know, the number of blog posts, the number of tweets. And, you know, part of it is that Romney wasn't around in 2008. Mm-hmm. But part of it is, too, that, you know, Obama sees it as a real galvanizing force. And the question always becomes in social media and politics is it effective? You know, does it get people to the polls?
Does it matter at
the
end?
And I don't know if that question can ever be answered, but I do know that there are studies that talk about how if your friends are on Facebook and Twitter and they are representing that they are behind a certain candidate, that you are more likely to take their recommendation of who you should vote for than you are any other form of communication.
Isn't it like that with anything, like weight loss or TV shows you should watch? I mean, if your friends are saying it, and that's part of the message. It's probably part of the reason why they want to reach the younger demographic as well, because you're so influenced, right?
It's true. Well, the other problem with this year's presidential election and social media was that Mitt Romney is obviously going for an older, was obviously going for an older demographic that didn't grow up, wasn't a digital native. You know, they've come to the party a little bit late, and that's not where his people are. So I think that, or were, I just don't think that from his point of view, it was an effective spend.
Do you think that the message changed? I mean, obviously, like you said, Obama was on Twitter, and that was a whole campaign effort on social media in 2008. Did you see a difference in how they were reaching out or how they were communicating over not just Twitter? I mean, social media in general this time around?
Yeah, it was much more video heavy. I mean, in 2008, you had Hillary announcing her candidacy by a video, if you remember. And this year, though, it was so much more video driven than it has ever been. I mean, you have the video on when Barack and Michelle Obama had their anniversary, where she did this wonderful anniversary tribute, and then that was shot out to everybody. And they used the videos in a very personal way. They actually, the Obama campaign had a Pinterest account, and Michelle had 8 different verticals that where she talked about, you know, food and who she, you know, the
right
who, fashion.
Who she liked. Yeah. Well, yeah, it wasn't quite that in depth. I mean, you could tell that one was more run by the campaign. And, you know, to the Romney's credit, Ann Romney had one too, and that was much more personal. And you know,
she did a great job, I thought.
That was one of the critiques, though, that I had of that campaign, was that they waited way too long to get personal. You know, I wanted to know much more about Mitt Romney. He was always on the defensive, defining who he was.
And, you know, we were talking about snarkiness before. There was a lot of snarkiness the day after the election, where there was this sort of perception that Romney was not responding to people on Facebook and Twitter, that, you know, the whole idea behind building a social media thing is you're establishing a relationship with your followers. I mean, and I'm sure that there are probably plenty of people in the Republican Party who would have liked him to sort of maintain some type of relationship, that maybe if he isn't going to run again, at least he's going to, you know, these are the people who are following you, these are the people who are interested in what you're sort of saying.
Well, even the Obama campaign, I remember looking into this, that it was mostly a one-way communication between the Obama campaign and their followers. I mean, maybe once they would do something in response to what one of their followers said. I mean, it was really just for them what social media is not, but it was a push out. It was, you know, here's the information, get out and vote, do all of this kind of stuff. Although they did do gimmicks, you know, have dinner with us and, you know.
Or the whole Reddit thing. You know, the president of the United States is on Reddit answering questions this afternoon. It's like, God.
And then the server goes down.
That is an entrepreneur's worst nightmare. Right. I remember one day we had really high traffic. And I would go to the site and it would say, error, HTML 500. You're like, no! We build it, they come, and you can't handle it.
No. Oh, my God.
So as far as going back to the website, I found it interesting the navigation bar, because obviously it's different topics, but it's very different from what you'd see on a normal, you know, traditional news site.
Right.
Tell us about we have them here: opinion, social media, cool tools, press, politics, and women.
Right. Well, women is a big thing for me. I mean, I've always wanted to do that, and I interview a lot of women about their role in media, but also about their work-life balance, because I think a lot of women across the country would like to hear, how do you do it all? Can you do it all? I mean, that is one of the biggest stories that that ran last year was a story out of the Atlantic by a woman who used to work in state and just couldn't handle it. She just decided, I'm not going to do this anymore. I'm going to be focusing more time on with my children. And so that, to me, is a really important part of the journalism discussion that I don't think gets as much attention as it should. So I've interviewed Betsy Fisher, who's the executive producer of Meet the Press, and she has a daughter and just recently got remarried to Jonathan Martin at Politico, about how she does it. I've talked to Kathy Merrill, who's the publisher of The Washingtonian, who has two small children, very cute, by the way. And she talks about her role for how she goes out at night, that, you know, they have a 3-night minimum rule and you don't go over the 3 nights and then you're home with your kids. And because, you know, there's a lot of social networking that you have to do in Washington. And so to me, I think those lessons are very helpful. And they're all lessons from female journalists. I mean, I struggled a lot with that issue until I launched my own company, Ashburn Media Company. And then we put out Daily Download. And, you know, in the beginning, I was working out of my house. You know, I was working out of my house, but it's so fabulous to be able to do that. I mean, I'm really lucky to have that opportunity. I would be there when my kids would get home from school and they would come in and I would get up and talk about their day, hang it up, get your homework, you know, do you want something to eat? Da, da, da. And then like a half an hour later, I'd be back at my office, you know, on the phone doing stuff. And then they would come in and ask for homework questions. I mean, it gets a little hairy, but, you know, I would try not to block a lot for that time. Now, I had the flexibility at that time to do it. You know, I wasn't doing as much on-air stuff. I wasn't living by sort of other people's schedules.
Right.
But I always try to do that. I always try to put my kids first, and I've done that throughout my entire career. I had the opportunity to take a big job right when my son was born 12 years ago, and I turned it down because I didn't want to be traveling the country with an infant. But you know, you always look back at that and you say,
I wonder what if.
And I think a lot of women, whether or not you're a journalist or not, but particularly if you're a journalist, with the demanding schedules and the on-call nature of it, you don't know when a new town shooting is going to happen and you're going to just have to pick up and go to Massachusetts for a week.
Well, you want to do it right. I mean, you want to do well in your career, and you want, and that means in journalism being accessible and being there and being ready to be, you know, work late hours. But I think it's interesting. It's sort of, I mean, you could almost run it parallel with like the financial aspect of it. Even though we go to these great journalism schools, they don't teach us how to have that balance, how to manage, you know, you're not going to make a lot of money. And if you want it, I mean, that's just it.
It's true.
And if you want to have a family life balance, this is how you do it. I mean, I think that's a huge part of, if you're going to choose a demanding career, there should be that sort of supplemental, this is how you do it.
And that's why this vertical is so important to me, because I remember in journalism school, I went to Columbia in New York to their graduate school of journalism, and I'll never forget Steve Isaacs, who was the assistant dean at the time, talking about the high divorce rate in journalism. And it was true. You know, you watched marriages just fall apart because it is. Well, and I don't know about any other profession, but I can say from the inside of journalism that it's true, because you've got, you know, somebody who's known as Baghdad Bob, making that up. That's actually from a movie. What movie is that from? Baghdad Bob.
Was it network news or
no?
Or
it wasn't. News? But I'll think of it in a minute. But Baghdad Bob, and it was Gina Davis, and they were the speech writers on the campaign, and she was going to have anyway. But he was called Baghdad Bob, which cracked me up because, you know, he was all about his career. He'd be like, "I want to marry you, but wait, can you just wait 1 second? I got to go do this interview," and she'd be like, I don't think so, Baghdad Bob. You know, I'd kind of like to finish the conversation about our future. And so, you know, you're right that people don't talk about that kind of stuff enough. And it scared me. I mean, I got married in 1993. I graduated from Columbia Journalism School in 93 in May, and I got married in June. So not only did I get my graduate degree, but I was planning a wedding. And then I had to move to Washington, which is where my husband worked. And I couldn't be in New York. I had a job offer in New York, but I couldn't take it. And I, you know, I worked as an overnight writer at WRC for Barbara and Joe.
Let me ask you this as a media critic. What does journalism need to do for women, both in its coverage, but then also from an industry perspective for the people who work in journalism?
Well, when I was at Gannett, there were very few, in the beginning, there were very few female leaders. Now, Gracia Martori is running the company as a woman. And I think that makes all the difference in the world at companies, the more women who are in the C-suite. You don't see that enough. And the reason that you don't see it enough is because of what we were talking about before, because it's so demanding. And if you're a woman who has come up through the ranks, you know, and you have made all of those sacrifices, and now there are all these women who want to have it both and want to work at home part time and don't, you kind of, they kind of feel like, hey, we paid our dues, you have to pay your dues. And so it's not going to be until the Marissa Mayers of the world, the new head of Yahoo, come in, who have a baby and understand the travails of this and the decisions that have to be made, are things going to change? I mean, it really is a top down.
Mm-hmm. Although she got a lot of criticism for, I don't know how this shook out, but when she announced that she was only going to take like 2 weeks leave after she gave birth, and I felt like there was some backlash from women about like, you need to stand up for us. You need to say you're going to take more time. I mean, it's like there's a little bit of like people are judging.
I think there's a lose. Yeah. It's a lose-lose situation in where whatever she does, whether she's, well, she's got to be a leader of a woman. She has to, you know, go in and back and take back her position. But then on the other hand, I think there's a lot of cultural expectations for women in any business.
And there's still a lot of sexism. Yeah. You know, I mean, take a look at the presidential debates. You know, Candy Crowley was the first moderator in 20 years, the first female moderator in 20 years of a presidential election. What?
Right.
Right. I mean, you know, Martha did the vice presidential one. But, you know, she did the vice presidential one. It wasn't the presidential one. And so there's a lot of that. You think that women are on an equal footing, but they're really not. And I hope to see it in my lifetime that there really isn't a difference in female and male journalists.
Yeah. As far as the Daily Download goes, what do you guys have future plans or any changes or exciting projects coming up for the next
tenure? We're launching a series of live events, which we're really excited about, starting with the inauguration. And we're doing a panel with this one. We're combined with Purple Nation, which is the group that Lanny Davis, former Clinton administration official, and Michael Steele, former RNC chairman, have put together for bipartisan solutions around politics. You know, and that's hence purple, red and blue, hence purple. And so that's a perfect group fit for us because we really would like to be seen as we talked about earlier in this podcast, we'd like to be seen as equal opportunity critics for both sides of the aisle. If somebody does something stupid as a Republican, or somebody does something as a Democrat, you know, we're there. And so that's what's really we're excited about that. Our traffic has just been a hockey stick, you know, going up and up and up. And I mean, you know, there are days, I don't know if you guys know Google Analytics, but as a web person, you know, my finger gets tired because I keep hitting, okay, refresh, let's see it, as a story just sort of takes off.
And exciting.
It's so exciting, but at the same time, it's really hard because you're out there alone. I have the grant money, which is, I just bow down to the Knight Foundation and to Eric Newton for getting us launched. Because I can't imagine starting something without having grant money. And a lot of people do it. They borrow, right? And they get, we haven't had to do that yet. But we, you know, we're looking to raise some angel money and to move forward to expand it into an even bigger footprint.
We ask everyone this question, and it's kind of a big question, so you can decide how you want to answer it. But how do you feel about the future of journalism as far as how, you know, legacy companies are taking on this new role of social, or how, you know, things are sort of adapting on television or through politics or however you want to answer it. But how do you feel about the way the industry is headed?
We're screwed.
Really?
I think so. I mean, from a financial point of view, there will always be this insatiable hunger for news. No question about it. Who's going to pay for it? Yeah. I don't know.
Everybody wants it, but they want to pay for it.
But they want it for free. And that was one of the biggest mistakes, I think, that major companies made at the beginning of this, is making things for free and never getting to some sort of pay model. Take Andrew Sullivan, who writes The Dish. You can go to andrewsullivan.com. He was affiliated with The Atlantic for a while. He was affiliated with Time. Now he's affiliated. Then he was affiliated with The Daily Beast, where I'm a contributor. And now he's striking out on his own. And he made a plea to everybody. It's not going to be a paywall. It's a subscription model where he said, for $19.99, we will work our asses off for you. And for $19.99 a year, and we will give you all the same great content. And we're trying to do this without advertising. And my hat really goes off to him. And he raised $100,000 in the first day that he said that. Now he has a team of six people. What, $100,000 is going to get you through like the next month, right?
Right, right.
But, you know, and so that's going to be a big struggle for him. But you also look at major corporations, print corporations, you know, traditional print organizations like USA Today and The Washington Post. Those big ads you see in The Washington Post go for hundreds of thousands of dollars,
yeah,
right?
But
or in the USA Today. But that is a shrinking market.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody's online, and in order to get $100,000 from, you know, a digital campaign, oh my gosh, it's going to have to last you 2 months, or, you know, I mean, it's just not the same. And so when I say jokingly that, you know, that we're screwed, I think somebody has got to figure out how to get the money, right? Somebody has to figure out how to get the money to pay for journalism, and especially investigative journalism, because
right,
that's the thing that has been hit. People are closing foreign bureaus left and right. It's just not tenable anymore to keep people there. I mean, even organizations who are, you know, local city organizations are shutting down bureaus in small towns. Remember the Trayvon Martin case? Mm-hmm. Nobody even knew about the Trayvon Martin case in Florida. The newspaper didn't for a week, because they had shut down the bureau in that town, and it just came across into the desk as another murder.
Wow.
We've been speaking to Lauren Ashburn of the Daily Download. We're going to sort of wrap up here. Thanks for coming in. Is there anything else you wanted to talk about or anyone want to say
go to the daily-download.com. That's another thing, is we have to have a hyphen in there because I couldn't afford the $50,000 to get dailydownload.com.
Oh,
so don't forget the hyphen.
Somebody's figured out that pay model.
Yeah, and right, on Twitter, we can find you at?
At Lauren Ashburn or at dailydload. And because at Daily Download was taken.
Of course.
You know what? It was taken by a spam bot. And Twitter
would
not give it up because it had high traffic. Anyway, the trials and tribulations of a media entrepreneur. Uh-huh.
Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to It's All Journalism, a weekly podcast about the changing face of the media. You can find out more about this podcast at itsalljournalism.com, or you can follow us on Twitter at alljournalism. This podcast was designed to be a two-way discussion about the future of journalism. We'd like to hear what you have to say. It's All Journalism welcomes suggestions from listeners about possible topics or interview subjects for upcoming podcasts. Email your suggestions to editor@itsalljournalism.com.